From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, terror on the land, terror in the sea. First, the threat of nuclear terrorism. National security expert Graham Allison says a terrorist nuclear attack in America is more likely than not in the next decade. Allison says bomb components are already available on the black market, but it's not too late to prevent a catastrophe. Then, Open Water, the new film about scuba divers abandoned at sea, is the latest reason to stay out of the ocean. We meet filmmakers Chris Kentis and Laura Lau. They put their actors in the water with live sharks to get the scenes that will scare you to death. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new retrospective of sax player Gary Window. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee are racing to organize confirmation hearings for Porter Goss. Today, the president nominated the Republican congressman from Florida to be the next director of the CIA. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly reports.
Porter Goss is the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Before entering politics, he spent a decade working for the clandestine service of the CIA. Goss says he's grateful for the chance to run the CIA and looking forward to the challenge.
I also look forward to the confirmation process with the Senate. As a member right now on the Hill, I know the value of that and the importance of that.
Democrats say they're concerned that Goss, a prominent Republican, won't be independent enough from the White House. Today, Jay Rockefeller, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, said appointing a politician is a mistake. But he added that he won't stand in the way of the confirmation process as long as Porter Goss is ready to answer tough questions about his record. Mary Louise Kelly, NPR News, Washington.
Leaders of the 9/11 Commission told the House Armed Services Committee today that creation of a single national intelligence director is an important step in getting intelligence agencies to cooperate in emergencies. Some House members and defense officials were skeptical. Commission Chairman Thomas Kane said action is needed in part because al-Qaeda has changed since the September 11th attacks.
What's happened to al-Qaeda is it's morphed into a number of organizations that are somewhat loosely affiliated under the banner, maybe, of al-Qaeda, but they're decentralized, and they're working, by and large, on their own.
Kane and Vice Chairman Lee Hamilton have been lobbying heavily for Congress to implement all the terrorism-fighting recommendations in the report. In Iraq, fighting continued for a sixth straight day today in Najaf between U.S. forces and militia loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. There's also been fighting in Baghdad. Security is tightening in Athens in advance of this Friday's start of the Summer Olympics. NATO AWACS planes are guarding the skies above the city against unauthorized aircraft. From Athens, NPR's Howard Burkus reports.
NATO's fleet of AWACS radar surveillance planes have begun operational flights, according to a NATO statement. The planes will fly at least 18 hours a day through the end of the Olympics. They'll search Greek airspace for intruders, providing an early warning system about aircraft that might pose a threat. NATO has also mobilized its entire naval fleet of 8 ships and a submarine, which are patrolling international waters off the Greek coast. Also on duty is another NATO force with expertise in combating weapons of mass destruction. All that's part of a $1.5 billion security effort, which includes 70,000 soldiers and police. Security officials have not disclosed any specific Olympic threat, but believe the Games could be the target of terrorists. Howard Burkus, NPR News, Athens.
The Dow Industrials gained 130 points today, closing at 99.44 in active trade. The Nasdaq was up 34 at 18.08, the S&P 500 up 13. This is NPR News. President Bush has been campaigning in Florida today with Arizona Senator John McCain at his side. Mr. Bush criticized Democrat John Kerry for saying yesterday he would have voted to authorize war in Iraq even if he'd known that no weapons of mass destruction would be found. Mr. Bush accused Kerry of changing positions on the issue. Kerry's most recent statements are in line with what he has said in the past, that he questions the way the Bush administration went to war, its preparedness, and its plans for peace. One of the civilian contracting companies implicated in the Iraqi prisoner abuse scandal has had its contract with the U.S. Army extended. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports that CACI will continue to provide the military with interrogators for at least another 4 months.
CACI says the extension of its Army contract is worth more than $15 million. The company says it has never found its employees to be guilty of any wrongdoing, but General Antonio Taguba's Defense Department report on prisoner abuse named 2 CACI employees who, the report says, tortured Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib prison. CACI is currently the subject of two lawsuits in civilian court. Both suits accuse the company of conspiring to torture prisoners in Iraq. Company CEO Jack London released a statement saying, "We have been resolute in our position that in wartime, we should respond when called." This new contract gives the company another 4 months providing interrogation services to the Army, with two optional extensions after that. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Today, the Federal Reserve Open Markets Committee voted to raise interest rates for the second time this summer. The federal funds rate moves from 1.25 to 1.5%. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment. At visa.com/signature.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. As horrifying as the September 11th attacks were, my guest Graham Allison believes it's more likely than not that sometime in the next decade, Americans will experience something far worse, a terrorist attack with a nuclear weapon. Allison's new book, Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe, is an alarming look at just how accessible nuclear weapons and weapons materials are, and why the nuclear programs of Iran and North Korea stand to dramatically increase the threat. Allison believes that a nuclear terrorist attack can be prevented if the United States changes course and makes nuclear safety more of a national priority. Graham Allison was a founding dean of Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government and served as an assistant secretary of defense during the Clinton administration. You open your book, Nuclear Terrorism, with a chilling anecdote about a tip that the CIA got just, I think, a month after the September 11th attack. I'd like you to describe that information and what it tells us about the state of our vulnerability to a nuclear terrorist attack.
Well, this is an actual incident, not well known because it turned out to be a false alarm. But just a month, almost to the day after the assault on 9/11, the director of CIA went into the president and said that an agent named Dragonfire, appropriately, had reported that Al-Qaeda had a 10-kiloton nuclear weapon from out of the former Soviet arsenal in New York City. And there was even some specific information about the characteristics of the weapon and the fact that it might have entered the U.S. from Canada. In any case, the alarm bells went off in the very, very inner circles of the U.S. government. And for several days, people had to confront the possibility that there was actually a nuclear weapon in New York. The president asked, could Al-Qaeda have a 10-kiloton weapon? The answer was, well, yes, they could. Were there 10-kiloton weapons in the former Soviet arsenal, some of which may be unaccounted for and might have found their ways into Al-Qaeda's hand? Yes, there could be. If it entered the U.S., would we know? The answer was, well, no, we probably wouldn't. If it's in New York City, can we find it? And the answer was, unlikely unless we get some additional clues. So for several days, people looked very hard at the problem. Fortunately, it turned out to be a false alarm. And in fact, they never even told Mayor Giuliani, who, after he learned of the fact later, was somewhat upset about it.
Everyone knows that a nuclear terrorist attack in the U.S. would be a catastrophe. But in your book, you describe in some detail what a nuclear weapon going off in Times Square would do. What was your purpose in going into that kind of detail? What would happen?
Well, what I do in the first chapter is imagine, as people had to do in October 2001 when they thought a 10-kiloton weapon was in New York City, if that weapon were exploded, a 10-kiloton weapon, what would the consequences be? Well, a 10-kiloton weapon is about the size of Hiroshima, to put it in perspective. That was 12 kilotons. For the first third of a mile from ground zero in all directions, one would have nothing. It would just be vaporized. It would disappear. And out to a mile, buildings would look like the Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City. So you could imagine 500,000 people dying promptly in such an attack in New York, if it was midday, when the place is crowded, and over time, several hundred thousand more, maybe even ultimately a million people dying in relatively short order. So it's just, this is a level of catastrophic consequence that most people can't imagine.
Well, let's take some of the places where weapons might be available. There were thousands of strategic and tactical nuclear weapons in the former Soviet Union. Is there evidence that some of them have already been stolen? What is the state of security at these weapon storage sites?
Well, now there's a Ukrainian friend of mine who, a number of these weapons were in Ukraine, he says, well, you keep talking about the good news, which is that all the weapons were taken back and, you know, are in Russia. But the bad news is that all the nuclear weapons are taken back and are in Russia today, where they're vulnerable to theft. They're in the efforts that have gone on over the last 12 years, the security at the nuclear weapon sites has improved in Russia, in a number of the sites, and the U.S. has been involved in assisting that. But it is still the case that about half of the weapons and potential weapons in lumps of highly enriched uranium and plutonium are relatively vulnerable. That is, they have not been secured to a level that we in the U.S. would regard as acceptable. And that means that there's 10,000 weapons that are at risk, some of them at facilities where, as I've seen with my own eyes, when you see a fence that it looks like it wouldn't be difficult to go through or go over, or a guard at a facility where there's no metal check for people coming out. And there have certainly been cases where material from which weapons could be made was stolen, but we know of no case in which a weapon itself was successfully stolen. Now, there's one of those sort of stories that's still out there that I've continued trying to trace down, in which a fellow named Alexander Lebed, who was Yeltsin's national security advisor for a while, acknowledged that 84 suitcase nuclear weapons, which had been made for the KGB back during the Cold War, were unaccounted for. The Russian government reacted rather strongly in old Soviet style by denying that there were any such weapons and then saying they had all been destroyed and then saying none were missing. So there was a whole bunch of conflicting stories that they offered about it.
Graham, I have to interrupt and ask you to explain what on earth is a suitcase weapon and what was the KGB doing with them?
The U.S. had something called atomic demolition munitions and other very small atomic or nuclear weapons that could fit in a backpack. And the purpose of these was for going behind the lines if there should be a war and blowing up bridges or blowing up headquarters or other. And in the Soviet case, they had these Spetsnaz units, which were very effective, which would go, again, behind the lines and try to kill the political leadership of a country or to blow up major buildings and facilities or headquarters or to blow up bridges. And small nuclear weapons were quite suited to that purpose.
Literally a nuclear bomb you could carry in a suitcase?
In a suitcase or in a backpack, absolutely. So the smallest ones weighed about 60 pounds and others weighed about 90 pounds. So that's heavy. So that's a heavy suitcase. But put in a backpack, one person could carry it quite adequately.
Apart from finding a already made nuclear weapon, the fear is that terrorists could build their own bomb. How much fissile material, that is to say, highly enriched uranium or processed plutonium, would a terrorist group need to build a bomb? I mean, were we talking about something that would you need a dump truck full? Would you need a suitcase full?
For the basic Hiroshima-style bomb, which is the easiest bomb to build, you would need about 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium. And since this is very dense, very heavy material, that would fit in a six-pack, roughly. So you empty out a six-pack of beer or Coke and fill it with highly enriched uranium, and that's about how big it is, smaller than a football. The design for the weapon is essentially a no-brainer, the Hiroshima bomb. That bomb was never tested. That design, actually, the first time ever used was used over Hiroshima. And that bomb would fit in the back of a van, like the van that the al-Qaeda terrorist Ramzi Yousif parked in the World Trade Center in 1993 when they tried to blow it up. So you're talking about something roughly the size of a football or smaller, a device which would fit in a van, and a design which is unfortunately rather straightforward and which has been public information now for 30 years. So it's a 60-year-old technology, therefore not rocket science.
Now, you said that you could fit enough highly enriched uranium to make a sizable nuclear weapon in a space about the size of a six-pack of Coke. Can you transport that safely? I mean, does it give off radiation? And could someone literally walk out with it and sell it without worrying about damage to their health?
The damage to the person would be quite small, since it doesn't have a big effect in terms of their health. In terms of the ability to detect it, it does give off gamma rays, which can be detected if unshielded. But again, unfortunately, if hidden in a lead container, like a camera bag, this becomes almost impossible to detect. So here nature is sort of against us and advantages the hiders versus the seekers. Since 9/11, there's been a major effort in research and development at the U.S. weapons labs and elsewhere trying to improve detection capability. But today, if a terrorist succeeded in getting 100 pounds of highly enriched uranium, their difficulties in bringing it into the U.S. would be slim, and our ability to find it if it's in a city is, as one of the NEST people, these are the people who are the teams that are prepared to go try to search, they say it is like looking for a needle in a haystack of needles. So we're not well advantaged there. The crucial thing to recognize, therefore, is that the source is the place to lock the material down and the place where we have the best chance of succeeding.
My guest is former Assistant Defense Secretary Graham Allison. His new book is Nuclear Terrorism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Graham Allison. He's the former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and his new book is Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. What role have Pakistani scientists and the government of Pakistan played in spreading nuclear technology?
There's been this fantastic story of A.Q. Khan, who's the father of the nuclear bomb for Pakistan, who is the global nuclear black marketeer, as we've learned over the past year, as the sheets have been, sort of pulled back. Here, this man, right at the heart of the Pakistani nuclear weapons program, who successfully stole technologies out of the Netherlands back in the 80s and surreptitiously built the Pakistani nuclear weapon using black market networks, then sort of flipped the switch sometime in the 80s, and began himself going, black marketeering these same nuclear technologies that he was developing for Pakistan. So this is a story most people just simply haven't gotten. But as the head of the IAEA, Dr. Al-Baradei, has said, he created virtually the Walmarts of proliferation, harnessing all the forces of globalization and the inventiveness of the market to supply people who had nuclear ambitions. Now, we learned the most about this in Libya, where now Libya, having come and confessed and opened itself, provide just a treasure of intelligence about how this network worked. Khan had set up gotten a company in Malaysia to set up a manufacturing facility to manufacture centrifuges, which are the machines that make the nuclear weapons material. He had gotten money flows through a Brit and an Israeli who were operating out of Dubai. He had some Americans even compromised in this process. So this was a global network for production. He ended up getting some uranium hexafluoride, it looks like almost certainly out of North Korea, to supply to the Libyans more than a bomb's worth of material, which if run through the centrifuges, these machines, would have produced enough highly enriched uranium for a nuclear weapon itself. And then he sold nuclear consulting services. So all this has been going on now. His markets or buyers included Iran, Iraq, Libya, and three or four more countries that have not yet been publicly outed, but which I suspect should happen over the next several months.
What consequences, what punishment did he suffer for his actions?
He went on TV, he confessed, and he was granted an instant pardon, and he continues to live in a rather grand house in Pakistan. He's as well regarded in Pakistan by the population as is President Musharraf. So this is a very difficult tightrope that Musharraf has been walking.
Is that a troubling lesson to be sending to people who want to engage in nuclear piracy?
You bet. And I would hope that Musharraf is squeezing him in order to get the information from him about the rest of this network so that it can be rolled up. I don't know that that's the case, and I worry.
Graham Allison, you write in your book that Americans are no safer from a nuclear attack today than we were at the time of the September 11th attacks. And the central reason, you say, is our war on Iraq. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is a tough proposition, but I have tried to analyze the situation carefully, and I would say the following. With respect to nuclear terrorism, what we know that there are people who would like to conduct a nuclear terrorist attack, bin Laden, the chief example, but not the only one. In fact, I give a half dozen other groups in my book. And that what stands between them and a nuclear terrorist attack? Acquiring a nuclear weapon. In the case of Iraq, there were no nuclear weapons. There was no nuclear weapons program. So this was a false premise with respect to the case that was made for war. But we also know that in North Korea, there are likely two nuclear weapons that were made under the previous Bush administration. But then there's enough fuel. There were 8,000 fuel rods that were frozen until January of 2003. Since which they've been being reprocessed to produce enough material for six additional weapons. So here we have in the case of North Korea certainly more potential nuclear weapons today than we had back before 9/11.
And are you saying that North Korea restarted its nuclear weapons program because we kind of took the eye off them because we were so focused on Iraq?
I don't think they restarted it because we had our eye off. What I'm saying is that while we've been focused elsewhere, they've been engaged in this activity with impunity. So they withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They kicked the inspectors out. They shut down the cameras that had previously been watching this material to make sure that it was not reprocessed. And they started reprocessing this material to produce enough stuff for six additional weapons. Now this, a country, North Korea, which is currently in the lingo called missiles or us. So they sell missiles to whoever will buy them. They've sold missiles to Iran, Iraq, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Libya, whoever will pay, they sell. They are potentially going to become nukes or us. And I think one has every reason to believe that if North Korea succeeds in becoming a recognized nuclear weapon state and completes its current efforts to have a production line for an additional dozen weapons a year, they will sell nuclear weapons to other states and even to terrorist groups. And I've written in the book, and I do believe this will be judged, if this happens, the greatest failure in American diplomacy in all our history, because a nuclear North Korea with a nuclear weapons production line will produce a world that maybe not just of one nuclear terrorist act, but of multiple acts. So the North Korean case has kind of gotten almost out of the barn while we've been focused on Iraq. That's the first instance. The second instance is Iran. Again, in terms of potential for supplying nuclear weapons to terrorists who could attack us. So this is the only, I'm only looking at this piece of being safer against nuclear terrorism. Iran has been, in the past 2 years, completing the infrastructure for its nuclear weapons program. Now, this gets a little technical, but I think it's this, if I explain it briefly. If a state is able to make highly enriched uranium, which you make by enriching uranium ore, or alternatively to make plutonium, which you make by reprocessing the spent fuel that comes out of a nuclear reactor, it then has the stuff of nuclear weapons. That's what's hard to make. That's what's hard to get. But once you have highly enriched uranium or plutonium, the rest of the process is relatively invisible and relatively easy. Iran is just about to complete the infrastructure for its nuclear weapons program as well. So while we've been focusing on a relatively minor, a bad regime, a bad man, a cruel dictator, Saddam Hussein, so I have nothing to say for him except that he was not the primary target. If your concern is a state and actors who would acquire and supply nuclear weapons to terrorists who could attack us.
Policy analyst and former Assistant Secretary of Defense Graham Allison. His new book is Nuclear Terrorism, the Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. He'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. And from Gotham Books, publishers of Almost French by Sarah Turnbull, based on the true story of one woman who finds adventure and the love of her life in Paris. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a husband and wife filmmaking team create Terror on the Water. We'll meet Chris Kentis and Laura Laup. Their new film is Open Water. Also, the music of tenor saxophonist Gary Window. And we continue our conversation about nuclear terrorism with Graham Allison.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to our conversation with Graham Allison. His new book is Nuclear Terrorism, the Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. In the first half of the show, Allison said he believes the U.S. made a mistake in focusing on Iraq and paying too little attention to more advanced weapons programs in Iran and North Korea. As to the notion that, the United States focused on Iraq while letting North Korea and Iran, letting their weapons programs grow unchecked, what about the argument that the invasion of Iraq, like the invasion of Afghanistan, sent a message to everyone that the United States will act with enormous force and will against a state it regards as a threat? That in effect, there is a deterrent effect that could have an effect on a Korea or an Iran.
Well, I would say that's I think that's a reasonable consideration, and I remember talking to Paul Wolfowitz about this, a person whom I know well. And I believe that was a good part of the core of their argument, that this was going to be easy, they were going to do it quickly, it was going to be seen as successful, and it would be a demonstration of America's unique military power. And there's, I would say, particularly if it had turned out to be a obvious and apparent success, and if there had been a nuclear weapons program, which, as I say, CIA never believed there was a nuclear weapons program there at this time. Their best estimate was that it was more than a decade away.
And you let me just interrupt there, Graham. You said that even though there have been a couple of recent reports which maybe re-examine this notion that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Africa, right?
I would say that Iraq had nuclear weapons ambitions is correct. I mean, Saddam never gave up his ambitions. The question is, how close was he to realizing those ambitions? If he had bought the yellow cake that President Bush talked about in the State of the Union speech from Iraq, imagine he had even bought it successfully. He's still a decade away from a nuclear weapon unless he's completed the facilities for enriching uranium. That's the hard part. Getting yellow cake is not hard. And in the
yellow cake is the crushed uranium ore, right?
It's an early stage of, if you think of it like gold, it's like it's gold that's been panned a little bit, but it's still not been refined in any significant way, and you're trying to get to 24 carats. This is way at the front end of the process and is not the hard part. The hard part is the centrifuges and a cascade of centrifuges that are able to enrich this to the 24-karat gold stuff that you need for the bomb. In the case of Iran, we had everybody agreed, all the intelligence community, all the national security community, that they were working this problem very hard and were getting closer and closer to success. And now we even see that we know more about AQ Khan's activity. He was one of their main helpers and suppliers. So I would say we get some effect, some demonstration, some positive demonstration effect from showing that we can crush a regime easily like Saddam and Iraq. But as we now see, we find ourselves left owning it and with a bit of a quagmire. And the most important thing, and this is my point, that while we were consumed elsewhere, if you look at the amount of energy and capital that of the president, of the secretary of state, of the secretary of defense, of the defense establishment, that was sucked into that hole, while North Korea and Iran have not been sleeping, they've been sneaking down the track as fast as they can.
You have a fairly well-developed suggestion on how the United States should deal with North Korea, which, as you said, is on the verge of being a country with a nuclear weapon production line and a willingness to sell it anywhere. How should we handle North Korea?
I think we need to take out all the carrots that we can imagine and mobilize them, both our own and carrots that can come from North Korea, from South Korea, and from Japan and others. And secondly, all the sticks, including all the sticks in our arsenal, and fashion a strategy on the basis of which we sit down with North Korea bilaterally now and say, we're simply not going to accept, and we can't live in a world in which you become a nuclear weapons state with a nuclear weapons production line selling nuclear weapons and materials to other states. That's unacceptable for us. So that's not going to happen. We've got to have a whole series of benefits for the North Korean regime if they go in the direction that we want. On the other hand, if you fail to do that, we're going to explore a whole set of options in terms of sticks, which start with sanctions, but ultimately contemplate military action to prevent this from happening. Now, playing out that hand in a careful way, in a manner that mobilizes what we can from South Korea and Japan and China, which has got a great interest in this, and Russia, is very hard to do. But if I contrast this strategy with the strategy of the Bush administration, it has simply been one totally befuddling. No carrots, so we're not going to give you anything, and no sticks. When you withdraw from the NPT or are reprocessing plutonium, we don't do anything to you. We simply tell you, we're not going to talk to you until you agree that you are going to eliminate your weapons program. And indeed, as President Bush said, and also commit suicide for your regime, because we want your regime to change.
Back in the Eisenhower years, the United States had a program to help develop third world countries called the Atoms for Peace program. I guess it was an effort to assist companies and countries in developing nuclear power. What's the legacy of that program for nuclear safety?
Ironically, danger. Both we, under the so-called Atoms for Peace program, and the Soviet Union under a matching program, provided research reactors to many developing countries and some what now turn out to be transitional countries, some of these powered by highly enriched uranium. Unfortunately, as a result of that, there are now about 20 countries where one can find research reactors, often risky and vulnerable to theft, at which you would find more than a bomb's worth of highly enriched uranium. And these include countries like Belarus or Uzbekistan or the Czech Republic, and even in Ghana, one's got almost enough material at a risky research reactor. In my view, and as part of this no loose nukes program, we would go around and clean out all that material, and I would say it should be done not on the current timetable where Secretary Abrams says over a decade maybe he's going to get the job done. This should be done this year.
Well, is it true now that even if one of those countries wanted to send its plutonium back to the United States, we actually charge them $5,000 a kilogram to take it?
Well, there's been this just bizarre, I mean, the stories in the bureaucracy are just hard to believe. But for a long time, now from the most risky ones, I think that's gotten adjusted. But for a very substantial period of time, the folks noticed that nobody was sending the material back. And one of the reasons why was they were being charged to do this as opposed to being incented to do it. So this has been a backwater in the Department of Energy. Secretary Abrams has now focused on it a little bit more clearly, and I think that he's got the right idea. He's just got the wrong timetable. It should be done immediately. We know how to do it. We've done it successfully now in three countries. In the former Yugoslavia, three potential nuclear weapons were taken out finally in the summer of 2002. Imagine that material was the stuff that powered the nuclear bomb that exploded in an American city. What are we going to say, well, it was scheduled for removal in 2007, but we just hadn't got there yet.
Well, Graham Allison, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for a great interview.
Policy analyst and former Assistant Secretary of Defense Graham Allison. His book is Nuclear Terrorism, The Ultimate Preventable Catastrophe. Coming up, what it's like to be abandoned on the open sea with nobody but the sharks. It's the subject of a new film called Open Water. This is Fresh Air. You want a real nightmare? Picture this. You're on vacation, enjoying a scuba dive with a recreational company, but when you come to the surface, the boat has left and you're alone on the high seas. That happened to a Louisiana couple left to fend for themselves in shark-infested waters off Australia in 1998. The incident provided the inspiration for Open Water, a new film by my guests, the husband and wife team of Chris Kentis and Laura Lau. The movie was shot on a minimal budget with little-known actors, but the terrifying scenes of the couple facing hungry sharks captured Hollywood's attention and has earned the film a wide theatrical release. It's been described as Jaws meets the Blair Witch Project. Chris Kentis and Laura Lau have made one other feature film, a 1997 movie called Grind. Here's a clip from Open Water in which the stranded couple are arguing. They're played by actors Daniel Travis and Blanchard Ryan.
Do you honestly, seriously, honey, do you honestly think that we got left behind because we were late? I'm serious. Do you have any idea how idiotic that sounds?
Oh, so now I'm an idiot? Well, we are where we are, aren't we?
Yeah, fine. Yes, because of me.
You refused to swim.
Oh, yes.
My God, they were both all around us and you refused. Now, look. Look around us. We are stuck in the middle of the ocean with nobody.
Even if we had been swimming for the last 5 hours, we would not be any closer to a boat than we are now.
I asked filmmakers Chris Kentis and Laura Lau what happens to people when they're out on the water with no hope of rescue.
A lot of things just physically happen and psychologically. I mean, obviously, you get very cold, dehydration, saltwater blisters and sores. You get victimized by, Mother Nature, if she decides to, throw a storm or something your way. There's sea creatures and things that eventually will get curious because, as you're out there and you're becoming dehydrated and your body's breaking down, you start to kind of resemble the food source of certain predators, kind of imitating what a wounded animal would be like.
One of the things that struck me was that when this couple emerges from their dive and the boat and their fellow divers are gone, they're remarkably calm at first. And it struck me that if I were in that position, I would immediately have a rising sense of panic. And I'm wondering how you kind of got into the frame of mind to try and capture what that first sensation and what those ongoing sensations would be like.
You can't help but draw from personal experience, and I've surfaced and not had the boat there. And the last thing on my mind was the panic. It was just a given. I'm on vacation. It would have been absolutely absurd to think it wasn't going to show up. I took advantage and snorkeled around for a while, and then after about 5 or 10 minutes, you get a little bit annoyed because you see, I paid good money for this, and I'm going to miss lunchtime if they don't get here. And in my case, after about 10, 15 minutes, they did show up, and that was that. So that was based on personal reaction.
Did the boat mean to leave you behind on that occasion?
Well, what happened on that occasion is that there was another diver was having an issue or some kind of problem involved their safety, and so they had to, go after this particular person and help them out. I don't remember exactly. And when you're in the water and you're just a head bobbing on the surface of the water, it's very hard to see things, even if they're, a few hundred yards away at times, depending on the seas.
One of the things that happens after they're on the open water for all these hours is that they begin to see the sharks. And I got to tell you that the hour that they spend in the water is one of the most excruciating hours I've ever spent in a theater. And the sharks in this movie are not these slow-moving mechanical beasts that we'd see in a lot of movies like Jaws. I mean, these are darting, thrashing, menacing, very real-looking, scary, tormenting creatures. And I'm wondering how you shot the shark scenes.
In most movies, when you see, in every movie that we can think of where there's a shark, basically somebody falls in the water, and before they know it, a shark is on them and rips them up. And that's really not how sharks behave, not from our experience and from our research. So we really wanted to portray them as accurately as we could. And what we did was, and we were also really interested in shooting the film from the point of view of the characters. And so we wanted to work with the sharks on the surface, which is an unusual way of, we think, of working with the sharks, shooting the sharks, portraying the sharks. And we used an expert down in Nassau, Bahamas, Stuart Cove, who is the go-to guy for film production and working with sharks.
And just to add, one of the reasons also, I think with the advent of Discovery Channel and Animal Planet and National Geographic, we're all pretty used to seeing sharks underwater. And frankly, I don't find them particularly scary. Even diving with them underwater, they're majestic and beautiful, but not exactly frightening. I've also been on the surface, and rather than seeing that smooth dorsal fin cutting the water like a knife that we're so used to, it's a sudden jolt, a violent flash of a tail, and it's quite disconcerting. So again, we wanted to shoot it from the point of view of those two main characters and take advantage of, I mean, you can't really see anything when you're out there in the water, what's under you or around you. And so we wanted to, exploit that fear of, what you can't see can be, more frightening than what you can.
How do you work safely with sharks? I mean, your actors were actually in the water, right, next to live sharks who were being, fed chunks of tuna?
Yes, they were. We were very clear in the audition process that really no actor should come out for the part unless they understood that they would be working with live sharks, that they would need to be very fit and get scuba diving certified. There were a lot of different parameters that we were looking for, as well as the way that we were working, which was with no crew. So the actors were needing to do, their own hair and makeup and costumes. But as regards to the sharks, once we had a script, of course we were not going to spare any expense when it came to safety, and we needed to know that we could get the shots that we needed to get. There were a couple of things. One is that, as divers, we had done some shark diving before, so we knew it was you could be in the water with sharks. Once we were down there, the actors had on anti-shark chainmail, and they were very restricted in their movements for safety reasons.
Beneath their wetsuits, it's a suit made of mesh metal rings, so the shark, if he bites down, his teeth can't penetrate. It's what the actors had on. I was in the water as well, and I tried that suit on, and gave up on it after about an hour because it was very difficult to grip the camera, and it weighed a lot. And the kind of housing I was using, they only design housings that take underwater, and it was heavy, and working with it on the surface like I was. So I knew we were in good hands, and it wouldn't be necessary to wear that. But we had it, we had it available, and the actors wore it.
No, I'm told
insisted on that.
And yes, Dave, you're right that what we did is our shark wranglers did, is we did have a big bucket of tuna. And what they would do in a very controlled manner is throw a piece of bait in the water, and the sharks would go in that direction. And then, we would set ourselves up, the actors and our cameras, and then they would move, throw another piece in, and the sharks would move in that direction. And we shot our shots that we needed with the sharks first. We shot really 2 days with the sharks out of a 6-week production schedule.
The opening of the film, I noticed, had a kind of a documentary look. It seemed to me as the couple was getting ready to go on their vacation, there were a lot of very tight shots, maybe just a little off mic in some cases, the camera maybe just a little jittery. And I'm wondering, were you trying to sort of capture a documentary feel here?
That was absolutely the approach we were going to take. In fact, one of the things, the pluses about the cameras we chose, the lightweight mini DV cameras, is they're very unobtrusive, and we knew we could go into the world, especially to the islands, and be shooting with them and capture real people just living in their lives and going about their business, and no one paid attention because we just looked like tourists shooting home movies. And that was the same approach with the dive boat. We filled it with extras. They were just people on vacation who are divers, and we paid for a free dive, and they were game to be in a movie. And it was same with the crew of the dive boat. We just used a real crew, knowing that they give these speeches every day, and we just had them do their usual pre-dive speech. And in the beginning of the film, certainly yes, that was the look we were going for.
You mentioned you're experienced divers, and you weren't afraid of sharks, but did anything ever happen on the water that really scared you, terrified you?
Yeah, it was the very first day of shooting, actually. We got Blanchard Ryan had just finished her checkout dive and become certified, and we were going to shoot the beautiful, pleasant dive that they do in the film, in which case we knew we needed to make sure we had some cool stuff to look at. And so we hired a wrangler who works with barracuda and feeds it bait fish. The bait fish are about the size of your finger. And we were instructed to make sure that we kept our hands, all our fingers, close together, our hands cupped, because when your fingers spread out, that looks like 5 bait fish to a barracuda. And Blanchard forgot this for a moment, and I turned my head and I looked back, and there's this cloud of blood in the water, and she was holding her hand, and my heart just stopped. And so we all raced to the surface thinking, I can't believe this. This is the first day of shooting, and is she okay? And all she was interested in was whether we got it on camera or not. And, of course, I missed the shot. But that was very scary.
Did that affect production? I mean, was she hurt? Was she okay?
She was actually okay. We were very lucky that it wasn't worse. It was a bite, and she has a little scar from it. But she didn't require stitches or anything. thank goodness.
And you didn't film her blood flowing away in the water, huh?
Oh, I missed it. In the second I saw what happened, the last thing I could care less about was the movie. The movie was gone. All I cared about was that she was okay. I mean, you know, all cameras off. We just raced to her.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Chris Kentis and Laura Lau. Their new film is Open Water. This is Fresh Air. English-born tenor saxophonist Gary Window divided his time between England and the U.S. Over here in the 60s, he studied with cool saxophonist Warren Marsh and played with the bebop bassist Tommy Potter. Back in England, by 1970, he recorded with art rocker Robert Wyatt and the big band Brotherhood of Breath. Then he returned to America to play with Carla Bley's Jazz Orchestra and with rockers like NRBQ. The saxophonist passed away in 1992. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Gary Window retrospective.
Tenor saxophonist Gary Window with jazz bassist Steve Swallow, rock drummer Dee Sharp, and pianist Pam Window, 1979. Over the years, many jazz musicians have made patronizing rock music, while rock jam bands have demonstrated their limited jazz skills. Gary Window was one of the rare musicians to make convincing statements in both fields with his highly personalized tenor style. Windows' raspy overtones, vocalized inflections, and shriek falsetto came from rhythm and blues saxophone, but he really pushed the special effects. He used tenor almost like an electric guitar. His hard, quick attack could sound like speedball picking, and he could make the horn screech like an amp feeding back. Windows could play, but more than that, he had a sound. Gary Window in a catatonic state, reconciling R&B hunker Junior Walker and howling free jazzer Albert Eiler, two of his heroes. This music's from Anglo-American, a new compilation of previously unreleased music by Window on the Cuneiform label. It takes him from London 1971 to Woodstock 1981 and shows he had more than one trick up his reed. He could be bluesy, out to lunch, gruff, and tender in the space of a few phrases. Thank you. Gary Windows' tune Baxter, performed with quintessential bar band NRBQ, whose pianist Terry Adams is another chameleon comfortable in jazz and pop. Windows spent some years in London, where the jazz, blues, and rock scenes were closer than over here, with musicians like Jack Bruce and John McLaughlin jumping from one to another. The London jazz scene was also sparked by a brace of South African exiles who brought a taste for fat, tuneful riffs and a big driving beat. You could hear all of that in the early 70s sextet Symbiosis, including Window, arty rock drummer Robert Wyatt, and South African trumpeter Mangezi Feza. On Window's Stand Fast, Symbiosis is part free jazz group, garage band, and What's for Tea Mum Village Orchestra. Gary Window didn't always boil over. The retrospective Anglo-American includes an overdub piece for soft-toned bass clarinets where he slaps the keypads shut for quiet percussion. That's an old sax player's trick, and the levy moan of layered reeds owes a debt to Rossan Roland Kirk. Gary Window valued such influences, but he had his own genius for fitting his voice into most any situation. For a freak player, he had some kind of excellent taste.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Downbeat and The Absolute Sound. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, publisher of Autumn Bridge, a novel set in 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka, author of Cloud of Sparrows. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the late 70s, Andre Stander was the youngest captain of the Johannesburg Police Force and South Africa's most infamous bank robber. There's a new movie based on his remarkable story. On the next Fresh Air, we meet the director of Stander, Bronwyn Hughes. Join us for the next Fresh Air.